This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the second hour of our program. It's Anything Goes Friday, but I do want to get a couple of guests in here this hour. First off, Matt Taibbi. He's a contributing editor at Rolling Stone, author of 5 books, and including his latest, I Can't Breathe, A Killing on Bay Street. His website is Hate Incorporated, and his Twitter handle is mtaibbi, M-T-A-I-B-B-I, or at Rolling Stone also. Matt, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
It's always nice talking with you, Matt. And, you know, it's always great reading your stuff. You've got 2 articles here that I think are absolutely fascinating that I wanted to talk with you about. The first is the Scarlet Letter Club, how the people who lied us into the Iraq War are still around and still doing this kind of stuff. And the second is how to blow $700 billion. It's easier than you think about how we're being ripped off by the Defense Department. Where do you want to start?
Well, I'm going to, the Scarlet Letter Club piece is something that I'm doing as part of that serial book, Hate, Inc., and that's on taibbi.substack.com. And I have another piece on that coming out in Rolling Stone today, so we should probably start there. But it's apropos. Because
there is kind of an intersection between the two, isn't there?
A little bit, yeah. No, I mean, one sort of fed the other. That was the turning point, actually, in the whole history of what we were going to do with the defense budget. Because if people forget now, in the 90s, there was all this talk of a peace dividend, and, you know, we were no longer going to have to spend all this money because the Soviets were gone. And the Iraq War sent us back on a schedule of continually ascending defense budgets.
Right. So who brought us the Iraq War, and how do we prevent that from happening again, being lied into a war by a president? It seems to me that we're about to be lied into a war in Venezuela and maybe Iran by Donald Trump as his reelection ploy, much as, you know, George W. Bush told his biographer, Inky Hertzwitz, in 1999, that if he became president, he was going to have a war with Iraq in order to get reelected.
Right. I mean, I think you could also characterize it as, you know, we have regime change plans that have really the playbook that we started with in Iraq has repeated itself over and over again. In multiple arenas, Libya was one. It's now going on in Venezuela, obviously. The situation is a little more complicated in Syria, but the archetype for all this was the Iraq campaign. And what's so amazing about this, you know, because I looked at it mainly from the standpoint of journalists and how we screwed up the story. A legend has emerged since then that the error was that we believed the intelligence that Saddam Hussein had WMDs, whereas, you know, we now know that WMDs was really an excuse that was kind of cooked up post factum in British-American negotiations to give the British political cover. The real reason is we just feel like regime change is the appropriate foreign policy, right, for in the post-Soviet universe, and the entire press corps missed that.
Well, and in fact, in a way, this was a repeat of the first Gulf War. I mean, when George Herbert Walker Bush, after April Gillespie, told Saddam Hussein that he could take back the 57th state, as I recall, which is what Kuwait used to be. It used to be a district of Iraq, because they were slant drilling and stealing Iraq's oil, and Saddam was appropriately, I think, upset about that. As soon as he invaded Iraq, George Herbert Walker Bush was also looking at his own reelection in 1992 and said, you know, okay, we'll have a war, but it's not going to be a quagmire. I don't want to have a Vietnam kind of war here. We're just going to have a little war like Ronald Reagan had. And of course, Bush was the vice president for that little war with Grenada. But we've got to convince people that there's a reason for it. So they get this woman who is the daughter of a Kuwaiti diplomat to come in and lie about how the soldiers are throwing children in incubators, you know, on the floors of hospitals, and everybody's
right,
horrified. And you know, again, we buy a BS story that is not, you know, the intelligence was not lying to us. I think in either case, the politicians were lying to us. Isn't that pretty much what happened?
I mean, a little bit of both. I think if you look back at the history of the Iraq War, you'll find that for instance, the British intelligence dossier, which was the first one that was released, was quite heavily edited. I mean, they originally came to the conclusion that Saddam could never build a bomb if there was a sanctions regime in place, that if there wasn't, it would be at least 5 years. And they originally edited it down to 1 year. There was some, you know, what they call stovepiping going on, basically, where the higher officials like Bush and Cheney were sort of reaching down into the raw data and taking what they wanted. But, you know, the larger issue was, It was the intellectual context within which all this was sold. It was the idea that, you know, not only do they have weapons, but that containment doesn't work, that Iraq was an exceptional threat compared to countries like Libya and North Korea and Iran. All of these things were falsehoods that kind of had to be smoothed over in the initial planning. And the journalists bought it all wholesale, whereas the public initially reacted with quite appropriate skepticism. That's why there were millions of people on the street.
The largest demonstrations in the history of the planet were the anti-war demonstrations against going into Iraq in the winter of 2003, as I recall.
That's right. The February 15th, 2003 demonstration was the largest demonstration in history.
Yeah.
And what's amazing about that is that, you know, I was one of the people marching that day.
Me too.
And you know, nobody in the crowd was like, gee, I really don't think they have weapons of mass destruction. But the tenor of those demonstrations was they're lying to us about everything, you know?
Right.
I mean, like, the whole pretext is wrong. Like, none of it makes sense.
Well, and there's another piece to this, Matt, that people were pointing out. I was actually on that day, Mark Crispin Miller and I were giving a speech in a church in Seattle, and we had, like, you know, it seems like 1,000 people, and it was spilling out into the streets, and then, of course, it went out into the streets. And my recollection of that speech, you know, that I gave at the time, was that in asking the question, why is it that we keep invading countries that have oil? You know, at that time, Iraq was,
right.
You know, Dick Cheney had just said Iraq had the second largest supply of oil in the world. Now we know that, and Libya has a massive supply of oil. So we went and we bombed the crap out of Libya and decapitated Gaddafi. And now we're learning that the single largest reserve of oil on Earth, it's not the sweet crude that we prefer, but is in Venezuela, apparently.
Right.
And
right.
So, gee, it's not just that we keep overthrowing governments, it's that we keep overthrowing governments that have, you know, within the top three amounts of oil on Earth.
Right, yeah. And we're going into places that have economic/strategic importance to us. They're not telling us the real reason. I mean, there's a whole host of sort of interconnected financial and bureaucratic motives. The oil was certainly part of the picture, and the public, I think, quite rightly sniffed that out from the very beginning. You know, we all recognized that the explanations they were giving us for why we were going in didn't make any sense. And what's so amazing about that is, you know, the only news organization, the only major one in America that didn't go along with this was the Knight Ridder News Service. So that tells you that, you know, journalists, our job is to be the tougher sell, right?
Yeah. Like,
we're supposed to be the people who are harder to fool.
Oh, journalists are supposed to be professional skeptics. I mean, it's
exactly.
It's journalism 101, you know? So,
right,
but they failed to do that. Matt, we just have a couple of minutes left. So what do we do about all this? And what do we do about how badly we're getting ripped off by the Pentagon?
You know, it's really hard to say. I think the problem with both of these issues, and especially with the Pentagon, is that you're never going to fix the issue of foreign adventurism and the continually escalating defense budget until you deal with campaign finance, because what happens is the weapons manufacturers just dominate the Appropriations and Armed Services Committees, which means you can never threaten to withdraw their funding for anything. So I think that's thing number one. People need to realize that until they get that under control, nothing is going to change.
And thing number two?
I mean, I think the thing number two that people talked about with the Pentagon, you know, when I did the story about how they failed their audit, they delayed for 30 years a congressionally mandated audit, Right. The Pentagon, you're never going to know exactly where all the money is until they have a modern integrated accounting system that goes throughout the entire system. Right now, the military is divided into multiple fiefdoms. Each service has its own multiple accounting systems, and they're resisting sort of doing one big computerized accounting thing like you do in any big corporation.
Right.
I think they're 20 years away from doing that, which means that we have 20 more years of not knowing where the money goes.
And in the meantime, as you documented in your article, How to Blow $700 Billion, you've got defense contractors that are double billing just as a matter of business practice. Oh, yeah. Hey, I got paid. Not bad. And all kinds of stuff.
It's amazing. I talked to one Air Force accountant. He's like, and he's telling me, you know, people honestly, contractors will honestly, you know, by accident send an invoice to the Pentagon and just get paid. And, you know, then his take on it is word gets around. Like, if you know how to write an invoice to the Pentagon, the money's going to come. And there's a million ways to rip off the system. And they have like 200 people watching all this money. It's, you know, it's ridiculous. There's more enforcement officers in the NYPD. It's absurd.
Right, and this is nearly $1 trillion a year. It's seven-tenths of $1 trillion a year. And then there's also the issue, and we just have 30 seconds, Matt, that about half the Pentagon's budget, I understand, has actually been privatized. It's going to private corporations to begin with.
Well, yeah, that's probably roughly about right. I mean, you know, the problem is the big five defense contractors, which I think is, you know, off the top of my head, it's Lockheed Martin, Boeing. I forget what the other three are, but you know, they take up something like 35% of the budget on their own.
Wow!
And because they have so much power, you can't withhold money from them because they just have so much control.
So it gets back to money and politics. The corporations are lobbying the politicians at the same time that the Pentagon is putting pressure on them.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Amazing.
So it's an endless cycle.
Amazing. Another couple brilliant pieces here from one of the best reporters and writers out there, Matt Taibbi at Rolling Stone. You can check it out, The Scarlet Letter Club and How to Blow $700 Billion. Hang on just a second, Matt.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Steps on that guy always steps on me. Matt, thanks so much for being with us today.
All right, thanks, Tom. Take care.
Good talking with you. We'll be right back with Anything Goes Friday. Stick around. And welcome back. Anything Goes Friday here. Justin in Lincoln, Nebraska. Hey, Justin, what's on your mind today?
Just climate change and the way people are responding to it. I mean, we had Mike Pence came out here because of all the flooding and everything, and the water that got into the wells, and the stores. I mean, people were buying bottled water. It was flying off the shelf. There was none there. It's pretty crazy. And I'm listening to AM radio, and there's a bunch of conservatives on there. And they're saying, oh, well, you know, this has nothing to do with man-made climate change. There's no such thing as man-made climate change. And I'm listening to that, and I can't believe it, you know. And it blows my mind. There were callers calling in saying, maybe there's something wrong with the sun, you know. No, you have to cut the ozone layer.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know. There was a bunch of engineers that called in, and they said all those bridges and, you know, all the infrastructure, it needed to be replaced because it was too old. But they're all Republicans, so they don't want to fund that. I mean, like, nobody wanted to, you know, replace that before or build a new one. Then nobody wanted to spend the money to do that. Now that it's gone, well, now it's time. So, I don't know.
Yeah, it's pretty strange stuff, Justin. It's pretty strange stuff. Do you see that? I mean, you live in Nebraska. You live in Lincoln, Nebraska. Do you see this changing, or do you think these people are genuinely brainwashed?
I think it's brainwashed. It's just so normal. I mean, like, You tune into the radio or something. Just the atmosphere, the people, like, this is the good old boy, you know, place. You know, I mean, everybody's just like, let's all agree on this thing. And if somebody says, hey, I don't necessarily think that that's right. I mean, there's all these scientists that say, oh no, those scientists are getting paid by George Soros, and they're just a bunch of socialists, and they're not telling the truth. Those teachers are brainwashing the children.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, I have a hard time. You know, you can't have conversations about politics and not even religion, I don't think. I wanted to throw this in there if I could. I just wanted to say, sure. I think tomorrow is International Atheist Day.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Happy Atheist Day.
Oh, yeah, it's tomorrow, yeah. So yeah. I
in
think,
advance.
But,
yeah.
But yeah, I just wanted to throw that out there. It's getting kind of weird, you know. And I also think, you know, maybe we should put something about clean water in the Constitution, you know, because that bottled water was not on the shelf and people were panicking. I mean, it was kind of weird. And we didn't really have that big of a problem here in Lincoln. I mean, but the water was still off the shelf, so
right.
I don't know.
Right.
Thanks for taking my call, though.
Yeah, you're welcome, Justin, and it might be a good, and thank you for the call. It might be a good time for those people who live in the Midwest to get some water filters and sterilizers. I mean, you know, we need to start thinking in terms of this is a new era. This is a new time that we live. If you live near a river, get ready for floods. Even if you don't live near a river, if you live on what formerly was a floodplain, you know, even a 500-year, 1,000-year floodplain, get ready for floods. If you've got a big roof structure, get ready for the tornadoes. I mean, pardon me. The weather has gone nuts, and it's gone nuts for two reasons. Number one, the jet stream is falling apart because the Arctic is melting. And number two, because we've had a one full degree Celsius of climate of warming, of global warming, the planet, which is 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit, the atmosphere of the planet now holds 5 to 6% more moisture than it used to. Well, you get more moisture, you get bigger storms. It's just simple math. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Wayne in Chicago. Hey, Wayne, what's up?
Hey, how are you, Tom? Happy Friday to you.
Thank you. Back at you, Wayne.
Yes, yes, Tom, this is just a continuation of what we were talking about last week about 5G. And I remember you said that the science said that 5G could not penetrate the skin.
Well, it's less, I'm guessing it probably can, but it's less able to than the frequencies that are used for LTE and 4G and 3G.
No, well, actually, they actually assumed that it could not penetrate the skin, Tom. And
well, they're using those same frequencies right now for the scanners in airports. And the whole sales pitch from those is that, you know, it can't penetrate the skin, therefore it doesn't cause any harm. I still feel uncomfortable whenever I had to go through one of those machines.
It was based on faulty intelligence about faulty intelligence that it doesn't penetrate the skin.
Okay.
But what they do is they completely ignore your nerves, your blood vessels, other structures in your body like bones that conduct electricity and carry radiation. So deep into the body also. So it's really going to be bad, Tom, especially for kids, like boys' reproductive systems especially. Like I say, man, I wish you were looking to it much, much further because from what I'm seeing, Tom, it's going to be a complete disaster from what I'm seeing.
It's going to be a giant experiment, Wayne, for sure. I mean, there were concerns back 100 years ago, 60-cycle AC. This was when George Westinghouse was having the wars with Thomas Edison. And Edison was saying that we should be using direct current, DC, you know, in our homes and all this kind of stuff. Westinghouse was saying, no, we should use AC. And in fact, Thomas Edison invented the electric chair as a way of demonstrating how dangerous AC was and alternating current. But the thing about alternating current is that it produces electromagnetic fields that we're all bathed in right now. We're all sitting here, and it does penetrate the body. We're all sitting here completely surrounded by 60 hertz fields. And there was speculation back in the days that that was going to cause sickness. And in fact, there's still some people who think that that's one of the reasons why we have, you know, some of the modern diseases and all that kind of thing. But it's, you know, it doesn't seem to have been, you know, to be turning out. We'll see, Wayne. But, you know, I agree with you. It's going to be a huge experiment. I just don't know that it's going to be that dangerous. But, you know, it entirely could be, and I get it. Wayne, thank you for the call. We'll be right back. It's 28 minutes past the hour. We're going to do an Anything You Know Is Everything You Know Is Wrong right after the break, and then we'll continue with Anything Goes
You're
Friday.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
It's Anything Goes Friday on the Tom Hartman Program, back with, well, first of all, Roger Thiel, and then your calls. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. You know how sometimes you know what you know, and sometimes you know what you don't know, and sometimes, like the Firesign Theater says, everything you know is wrong.
You know that you're wrong,
but you fear you're right.
You suspect you're out of sync.
Is it possible to control your diet with your and your weight ultimately with your mind? Roger Thiel is with us. He's a historian. You may have seen him on the History Channel. His latest book is called My Diet Is Driving Me Crazy, which is also the name of his website, mydietisdrivingmecrazy.com. And the book is out there and available right now and all the normal books places. Roger, welcome back to the program.
Hey, great to be with you, Tom. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. We were on with you last time about your book about the Civil Air Patrol, which was absolutely fascinating. So, first of all, give me a quick summary of the book. I used, you know, affirmation and kind of self-talk when I was in my early 20s to really, you know, it really transformed my life, you know, to convince myself, as it were, that I could become a successful business person and a successful author. How do you use this, you know, internal conversation to make your diet work?
Okay, fine. Well, this is a new series of books which support your existing diet with courage, humor, and entertainment. Now, you can also turn to them in an emergency, so we even call this instant emotional support for your diet.
Wow.
Now, each volume has 10 very short stories and about 32 dieting affirmations, which we call insights. The stories are very special. They, get this now, they place you in the mind of a dieter, usually when tempted by food, and you are there as the dieter finds the courage to overcome that temptation, and this feeling of winning rubs off on you. So it'll help you win your own daily diet battle. That's all new, just out since January.
Fascinating stuff. We're talking to Roger Thiel, his new book, My Diet Is Driving Me Crazy, which is also the name of his website, which is fascinating. So what motivated you to write this book, Roger?
Yeah, well, last fall, I went to a large bookstore, not as usual to the history section, but quite frankly, to support my own diet. Now, every book in the section called Diet and Nutrition is worthwhile, but most of them felt so clinical or tedious, and there was very little about emotion and almost nothing that felt entertaining. But then I happened to walk by Fiction and Literature, and I remembered the deep emotions of storytelling. So I decided to write my own set of books, and they include the special dieting stories. They're only each half a page long, and I'm very excited about it.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. Would you like to tell you have a brief life-changing insight about Charles Dickens?
Oh, yes, yeah, Charles. What we do is we're coming here to story, and I'm about to, in fact, give you summarize one of our stories in the book. But to give people an idea of the power of story in our lives, 175 years ago, Charles Dickens was going to write a pamphlet for the people of England to say why the rich should help the poor at Christmas time. But he didn't do that. He decided he would turn it into a story, into fiction, and by writing A Christmas Carol, he multiplied the message a millionfold. It's become part of our culture. Everybody knows. But let's remember, this is because he used story.
Right. And I mean, story is powerful stuff. We are, I remember Robert McKee once saying that, you know, we actually are kind of biological story machines. That's one of the things that's kind of unique about humanity is that we learn culture through story. We remember things best through story if we can insert data into stories. And we motivate ourselves with stories. We tell ourselves stories about who we are. We tell ourselves stories about the rest of the world. How do the stories that we tell ourselves about diet work or not work generally, Roger?
All right, fine. Well, most other diet books usually offer, you know, clinical instructions or lists of food, what you may feel when you go through the diet section in a bookstore.
Right.
We do the exact opposite. Most diet sources would expect you to use willpower or discipline or maybe your conscience or maybe some technical advice or maybe a sense of duty, but no, these stories give you the sudden emotional feeling of winning the diet game, and they're very short. So I'm going to summarize one. Our website even has a, under emergency support section, it has a subject index which lists stories for quick reference in different situations. So let's say you're concerned about food temptation in a supermarket. So then our subject index can refer to you to a supermarket story which begins as a dieter returns a bag of candy to the shelf with pride. But then in the checkout line, the wall of candy bars is just so very tempting, and the dieter thinks, well, I just did something so good, maybe now I can. But then this dieter, while you are reading or listening, finds the courage to resist food temptation again. Right. And you feel the success on the level where it counts, the deep emotional level.
Right. It's remarkable stuff. The book is My Diet is Driving Me Crazy, which is also the name of the website, mydietisdrivingmecrazy.com. The author is Roger Thiel. Roger, thanks so much for dropping by today.
Okay, very good. You bet.
Yeah, great talking with you. Roger is one of the most fascinating writers out there. He's done so much eclectic stuff. Anyhow, let's get back to Anything Goes Friday. Morris in Long Beach. Hey, Morris, what's on your mind today? Thanks for listening to KPFK.
Hey. All right, I hope we got us some time, my brother. I just wanted to know what your definition of American exceptionalism was.
Oh, man. I've got my this is what I think it really is definition and my kind of sarcastic definition. I mean, you know, the thing that is largely unique about the United States, although it wasn't, as you and I both well know, it wasn't appropriately executed at the time, is that it was a nation that was founded not on DNA, not on race or tribal identity, although, you know, ultimately that ended up being a large part of the case. It was, you know, of by and for white men. But nonetheless, the founding of the Republic was based on the ideas of the Enlightenment, based on, you know, everything from Thomas Hobbes to John Locke, and, you know, Thomas Jefferson was one of the great Enlightenment writers. And so I would say, you know, the fact that's the exceptional thing, that we were founded on an idea rather than you know, a lineage. You know, I would say that my sarcastic response to it is that we think that, you know, that we're superior to all other nations and all this kind of thing. And there's been a lot of nations since then that have said, no, we're going to do the same thing. We're going to found our nation on egalitarian ideas of fairness and equality and things like that. And a lot of them have done a much better job than us now. What's your definition, Morris?
My definition is page 43 of a book written by a lady named Betsy Hartman, no relationship to the host. It's called The American Syndrome, Apocalypse, War, and Our Call to Greatness, page 43. Very, very outstanding. Mm-hmm. Also, I want to say, Professor, I've been listening to, while I was on hold, I've heard you read about three books. Alan Lichtman, I like his book, White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the Conservative Movement, particularly page 204. And Frederick Douglass once said that an oppressor ever finds in the character of the oppressed justification for the oppression. And sure. I'd also like to refer you to the American Heritage Dictionary. Look up the word ethnic. Now, most of the time, words have more than one meaning in dictionaries. For example, ethnic means someone that is not a Christian, someone that is not a Jew, but someone that is a heathen. So there's a undercurrent, Professor, in our culture with regard to people, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I had no idea that was one of the definitions of ethnic.
Check out the American Heritage Dictionary. I know this because I did a research paper in my systematic theology class. That's
yeah,
why I
no, I believe you.
Love.
I believe you. I've never gotten bad information from you, Morris. So you're,
I love you.
Well, thank you. Back at you. So you think that American exceptionalism has turned into, and I think you could argue that it was from the founding of the Republic, whether it was the Monroe Doctrine or whether it was, you know, the genocide of the Native Americans or whether it was, you know, the Trail of Tears with Andrew Jackson or whatever, that America's real exceptionalism is that, you know, we have become an empire based on basically war and domination of other countries. If that's your point, I would not disagree with that, but I would say that really doesn't make us exceptional. A whole bunch of empires before us did the same thing, the French, the British, the Spanish, the Dutch, the Greeks, and the Romans.
And we all had one thing in common. Anytime that people feel that they're God's chosen people, that also means that they're God's chosen race, and boy, does that create problems for everybody else.
Yeah.
Right? But read page 43. I think she articulates it pretty good.
Okay.
Better than I could.
Okay. You want to?
Thank you.
Thank you, Morris. Good to hear from you. Magnus in Vinilhaven, Maine.
It's Vinyl Haven.
Vinyl Haven. Plastic. Okay, great.
Yeah. Yeah, you're still doing God's work, Tom.
Well, thank you.
I'll give you a bumper sticker first. It's it ain't class warfare because thieves got no class.
Okay.
And I like to call President Trump, and it should stick because he does it every day, President Projection, Projector.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I'm an Icelander originally, and I know for a fact that there's a bus in Reykjavik that for the last couple decades, and it's a Mercedes. Oh, they fixed up a diesel engine to take hydrogen, and it's been working fine as kind. So it's not really all that new technology, and it can be, you know, if they can do it, we can do it.
Yep, yep.
And there's one more little thing about Iceland, the healthcare system, which is, you know, we don't have to pay or worry about that, which is helpful with health anyway. But here in this country, when they're making policies, and policies means it's intentional, it's manslaughter.
Yeah.
It's manslaughter. That's what. It's nothing else. If people die because these guys need to make money, then that's all it is.
Yeah, it's certainly what it's become. Magnus, thank you.
Thank you.
Said. And nice to hear from an Icelander who loves the healthcare system in Iceland. That's it's remarkable how uninformed the average American is. It really and truly is. We'll be back with Anything Goes Friday. Well, actually, we're going to check in with Talk Media News. No, we're not. We're going to do that in the next hour. We'll be back with your calls. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be right back with more of your calls on Anything Goes Friday. Stick around. And welcome back. Let's see here. Maura in Linwood, Washington. Hey, Maura, thanks for watching Free Speech. What's up?
Hi, I watch you every day that you're on.
Well, thank you.
In fact, we could be related. I'm half Norwegian and half United Kingdom.
Ah, well, we country. Probably are. Norway's a fairly small country.
Yeah, somewhere. Yeah, but what I want you to recharge your battery. I don't know if you've ever been to Timberline Lodge or whether you've driven the old Columbia River Highway. They were both built when Franklin Delano Roosevelt was president. The workmanship is magnificent.
Timberline is the lodge that is on Mount Hood, right?
Yes, it is.
Yes, Louise and I have been there. We've been there.
Okay. Did you realize that it was built in 1936?
Oh, yeah.
During the time?
Yeah, they have a plaque. They have the whole description of how it was part of the WPA, as I recall.
You're right, yes, and the workmanship. You can see the love the men put into it. And have you gone up the old highway, the old Columbia River Highway, and gone to Vista House? The highway is lined with rock walls that were built during that time. Huh. And Vista House is, you get up above the gorge, you know, you can see the whole gorge, and this wonderful building was built, I believe, at that time.
Yes,
too.
We've been there, and too. That, in fact, I think that was built in the 20s, wasn't it? Wasn't that built little earlier than that?
That might have been,
because it was built by a wealthy guy, as I recall.
I think it was Hill. I think his name was Hill, and he was a railroad man.
Okay.
Well, there's a lot of places to go in Oregon. I was
there
born
really
and
are.
Raised there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you been to Astoria? Have you been to the old Astor Tower in Astoria?
Yeah.
Climb up to the
top? I climbed it. Yeah.
Oh, it is. Astoria is just an amazing town.
Yeah. Well, it's a wonderful state, and I think you're in God's country, and you deserve it.
I agree. Not that I deserve it, but I think it's God's country.
No, but I know it is, and I miss it. I'm in Washington because I need to be near my children now. Mm-hmm. But I also wanted to tell you that thank you for putting Mount Hood out there. My grandma was 12 years old when she came from Norway to Minnesota, and she married my grandpa, who was also a full-blood Norwegian. And they went to a little town called Scotts Mills. They had two or three children by that time, and they went to Scotts Mills, Oregon, which is still, that little town is there, but they were going to work in the mines to get ore out of them, iron ore. Well, that petered out, so they built a lumber mill instead on the little river there. And they lived up on a hill, and she missed Norway. And Mount Hood was her mountain.
Yeah.
And I think about my grandma every time I see your program and your mountain.
Okay.
And it's and I just feel like I'm a kindred soul of yours, and
well,
I learned
well,
so
well,
much.
Well, thank
you,
Maura, and I appreciate the call. And I got to tell you, whenever I'm guessing that a lot of people don't realize that you can literally be driving down the street in Portland, and you can see Mount Hood. I mean, you can just see Mount Hood. In fact, some days you can see Mount St. Helens, you know, on a clear day. This is just such an amazing city and such an amazing part of the world. Maura, thank you so much for the call. And fascinating. It's nice to meet somebody who's probably a relative. We'll be back. It's coming up on 10 minutes before the hour here on the Tom Hartman program. We'll be back with more of your calls on Anything Goes Friday. Welcome back. Fritz in Palm Desert, California. Hey, Fritz, what's on your mind today?
Well, Tom, it just occurs to me that the 25th Amendment allows the president to step aside temporarily. And I think that the argument that the president is too busy is precluded by that amendment when he can just step aside. But, of course, that would leave the real possibility that a President Pence would pardon him.
Right.
Still.
Well, and not only that, the problem with
against it.
Right. The 25th Amendment was really designed. I mean, it was in the wake of Woodrow Wilson having had a stroke, Franklin Roosevelt having had a stroke and ultimately died from it, and then John Kennedy's assassination. It was, you know, what do we do with a genuinely disabled president? I don't think it anticipates a psychotic president. Or a narcissistic president, or a sociopathic president, and because you have to begin the 25th Amendment in order to start the process, it requires the vice president and a majority of the members of the cabinet. And
no, I'm not talking, Tom. I'm not talking about removing him. I'm talking about him facing criminal charges, stepping aside temporarily to defend himself in a criminal case.
Okay, but see, the 25th Amendment requires that they say that he's not able to perform his duties of office.
No. He could do it voluntarily.
Oh, well, he could do it voluntarily anytime. He doesn't need the 25th Amendment.
Right. And therefore, this argument that he's too busy or can't defend himself is precluded by the 25th Amendment, which allows him to temporarily step aside.
Sure. I get your argument, Fritz, and I don't disagree with it. I think the fact that Trump is spending more than half his days now watching Fox News and tweeting, and that's on the work days, and that he's spent more time in his golf courses than certainly than President Obama did in 8 years. He's spent more time in golf courses in 2 years. Should tell us that advice from the Justice Department that the president is so vitally busy concerned with affairs of state that he shouldn't be pestered or bothered by something like a criminal investigation or an indictment is BS. But that's what William Barr, who is the attorney general, who covered up the crimes of Reagan and Bush when he was the attorney general under Bush the Elder, that's what Bill Barr is saying. That's the position he's going to take. There's nothing we can do about it, to the best of my knowledge, other than just yell and scream loudly and show up in huge numbers in 2020 at the polls. But, Fritz, I totally get your logic. Thanks for the call. Tim, in Beaverton, Oregon. Hey, Tim, what's on your mind?
Yeah, yesterday I was listening to your program, and I watch Free Speech TV every day. You do a great job, Tom, to begin with. I just wanted to comment.
Thank you, Tim.
Yeah. It's one of the few options that people that have a progressive base can actually learn something and communicate. It's scary, based on what's happening in this country.
Yeah.
But you were talking about these mass shooting, these mass shootings. Basically, that's part of the Republican ideology now. Whenever something like that happens, that Fox News, the NRA, and the Republican hierarchy are behind closed doors popping the champagne corks, because all that does is shore up their white nationalist Second Amendment base. There's no question about it.
Sure. And sometimes they come right out and say it. Sharon Engel said this about Harry Reid, as I recall, or maybe it was somebody else she was running against. I thought she was running against Harry Reid. And then Donald Trump said the same thing about Hillary Clinton, that there would be a Second Amendment solution, which is code for somebody's going to kill somebody.
Isn't that scary?
I think it's profoundly scary. And I think it's twisted. I mean, it's just twisted in a way that is such a distortion of the fundamental values of this country, or any country, frankly, humanity.
you know, I have 2 degrees in history. We just don't, we aren't learning from history is what we're doing. The subjective nature of education is taking a beating in classrooms right now. You know,
yeah.
Everybody wants to push buttons, basically. And then one little simple comment about Trump. You know, I mean, it's hard for me to even say that he's president. That's how despicable this whole situation is. But what he does is I think he incorporates the lunacy and the viciousness of Dick Cheney and the stupidity of Sarah Palin. Those are the two common features that I think that incorporate the Trump presidency,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, tragically. And then he has surrounded himself with some very, very efficient thieves, basically. You know, he's got, you know, one of the most corrupt cabinets in the history of the United States, too. Tim, I want to get a couple more calls in here before the hour's out. Thank you for your call. Charles in Murray, Kentucky. Hey, Charles, what's up?
Well, Tom, last Wednesday you made a quick comment that solidified my understanding of why the evangelicals are so enthralled with Trump. I was raised in a Baptist family. My church was a Baptist family. And we all had very special things we looked at to direct us. We looked at God first, then Christ, and right below them was our pastor who stood in front of some priestess all day long.
Mm-hmm.
And we were intent on following what was there. Luckily, I had some great teachers in school that taught me to think.
Mm.
That seems to be what they're trying to get rid of now with our educational system.
Sure.
But, we have this thing got into us from childhood of having a fearless, very strong, dictatorial type of leader. And I feel this is why the evangelicals today are flocking to Trump.
Yeah, I think what you're referring to that I said last week was that I believe that most evangelicals, or at least many, I think it's frankly most evangelicals who follow Trump, are not doing so out of religious conviction, and they're not even necessarily doing it because they were told to by their leaders, although there's a piece of that, but it's that they are authoritarian followers. So if their leaders tell them to do something, they do it. But even more than that, Trump is out there playing Big Daddy. He's saying that he is the authoritarian leader, and so people who are just kind of inclined to be authoritarian followers are like, oh, cool, I'll follow him. I mean, essentially, that's what you're saying, is it not, Charles?
He's their version of God today, and you know, they just follow him. Whatever he says, that's what they're going to do.
Yeah, yeah, it is.
He was right when he said he could stand out in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody, and nobody do anything about it.
No, he was bragging. He was not exaggerating. And Michael Cohen pointed to that in his testimony before Congress. That, you know, when Trump said that, he was dead serious. He was bragging. He was not making a joke. And you know, we need to take this stuff seriously. We need to take it very seriously. And the evangelical support, I mean, you know, this in part, thank you, Charles, for the call. I think that part of what Trump is doing with regard to Israel, moving the capital to Jerusalem now, you know, recognizing the Golan Heights as Israeli land, a lot of this has to do not so much with his sucking up to Bibi Netanyahu and helping his friend Bibi get reelected, although there's a big chunk of that, but also with satisfying the Christian evangelicals who want the world to end in a nuclear war that starts in Israel. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.